This is Central Time. The Trump administration released new travel restrictions last night. The countries affected are Chad, Iran, Libya, North Korea, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen, with partial restrictions for Iraq and Venezuela.
The new travel restrictions vary based on the country and will be phased in beginning next month. On Sunday night, President Trump tweeted, "Making America safe is my number one priority. We will not admit those into our country we cannot safely vet."
Shobha Siva Prasad Wadia is an expert on immigration law and a clinical professor of law at Penn State University. She's also the founder and director of the Center for Immigrants' Rights Clinic. Shobha, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
Well, how do these new travel restrictions compare to the first controversial travel ban that President Trump signed as an executive order earlier this year?
Sure. So it's a great question about how we even got here. In January, the president signed his first executive order, and by its terms, that order banned entry temporarily for individuals from 7 Muslim-majority countries, as well as refugees, and indefinitely banned Syrian refugees. There was litigation that followed, and in March of this year, the president signed a second executive order on immigration with similar travel restrictions, this time 6 countries instead of 7, also including a refugee admissions suspension for 120 days. And that, too, was met with litigation. Both rounds of litigation revolved around challenges under the U.S. Constitution, as well as the U.S. immigration statute called the Immigration and Nationality Act. And the U.S. Supreme Court in June of this year agreed to hear oral arguments, which it hours ago has just canceled until further notice, and also created this murky, temporary, bona fide test for reinstating part of this second ban for individuals who lack a credible bona fide relationship to a person or entity. So what happened last night? You might call this the third version, and it was issued as a proclamation as opposed to an executive order, and it cited to various authorities in the Immigration and Nationality Act. And as your presenter announced, there are 8 countries covered, so there are a few new ones from the first two orders: Chad, Libya, Iran, North Korea, Somalia, Syria, Venezuela, and Yemen. And the restrictions seem to be country-specific. For Chad, Libya, and Yemen, anyone who is seeking entry as an immigrant, so somebody who is seeking entry on a permanent basis, or as a tourist or business traveler, are restricted. With regard to Iran, all immigrants and non-immigrants are restricted except for FJs and Ms. And F refers to temporary student visa holders. Js refer to exchange, Fulbright scholars, and so on. M is another student visa category. For North Korea and Syria, all immigrants and non-immigrants are covered under this new travel ban. For Somalia, all immigrants are covered, and then any non-immigrant or temporary visitor is subject to extra scrutiny. And then finally, Venezuela, certain government officials and their family members are subject to a travel restriction. This restriction is indefinite, so it is different in its timeline and duration than the first two executive orders. One country dropped from the list in the wake of last night's proclamation is Sudan. So that just gives you an overview of what is inside of the proclamation. And I'm happy to cover exemptions and things like that if that's of interest.
Well, and did the White House reveal any of its thinking behind the changes on the list this time around?
What you will see on paper as you review the proclamation is a country-by-country description by the White House about the reasons why certain elements of security or information are inadequate. So it did provide more of a narrative, if you will, for why these countries were chosen and why specific restrictions are being imposed.
And Shelby, you mentioned that oral arguments, which were scheduled coming up in October, have been canceled. What is the thinking behind that, and what might we expect from a legal perspective now?
Well, a final decision on whether or not the case itself is moot has not been made, but it seems reasonable, I think, that the oral arguments, which previously were scheduled for October 10th, have been canceled until more briefing and letters can be filed by the various parties. I think the court wants to see how does this brand new 16-page proclamation impact the current litigation? What's the relationship between the second executive order and this new proclamation? Those are some of the questions that the court seeks to have answers to before making a decision about what to do next.
We're talking right now about new travel restrictions from the Trump administration with immigration expert and Penn State law professor Shobha Sivaprasad Wadia.
You can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. What's your take on these new travel restrictions? Is your family affected by these new restrictions? And do you think this list of these new restrictions will stand up in court? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Shobha Sivaprasad Wadia is with us from Penn State, looking at the Trump administration's updated travel restrictions.
You can join in now, too, at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the new restrictions? Do you think these travel restrictions will stand up to legal challenges? Do you think it's a step in the right direction for U.S. immigration policy? And does this affect you or your family? Call in now at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. And Shobha, the executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union, said that even though there are nations in this new list that aren't majority Muslim that were added, this is still what they call a Muslim ban. What do you make of their position, their statement?
So speaking just in my individual capacity and not for the university, I would personally characterize the restriction in that way. The countries targeted are still ones that primarily have Muslim populations of over 90%. If you look at admissions from North Korea, one of the non-Muslim majority countries, you'll see that it's a pretty trivial number, and the restriction on Venezuela is much narrower than with the others, and Chad is a Muslim majority country. So I think that it's a fair characterization by ACLU.
And how do you think this could change the shape of legal challenges going forward, this third, as you called it, iteration of a travel ban?
It's hard to know. We know the administration has taken time to develop this third version, and perhaps it did so through a proclamation as opposed to an executive order for specific reasons related to the courts. What I haven't done the homework on but I'm curious about is the degree to which courts will defer more often to proclamations than, say, the terms of an executive order. We also see in the language of the proclamation a closer relationship and consistency between the suspension language and the immigration statute. So I wish I could do more crystal balling, but that's all I have at this point in deciding whether or not the courts will look or consider this differently. I would say that those who have already brought litigation, at least some, are of the mindset that this version is still unconstitutional and in violation of our immigration statute.
As an immigration expert, what is your take? What have you seen so far and heard about how the travel bans, all of them so far, have affected people around the world and here in this country?
Sure. In the country and beyond, it's isolating, and it sends the message to the world that people are not welcome. And so my personal view is that to keep issuing bans that exclude people based on where they're from is un-American. And the practical effect might be, in the long term, fewer people having interest in coming to the United States to study or pursue the American dream. On a very practical level, I've had several calls, even in the last 20 hours, from individuals with questions about, I have a relative who has an application for a tourist visa wanting to visit maybe for a graduation or for a significant event, but from an affected country. How will that impact the relative's ability to visit and enter the United States?
And how would you summarize who's lining up on both sides of this issue right now?
So I would say that on the side of criticizing the version that was signed last night, that might include immigrant rights groups, immigration lawyers, ACLU, those who are plaintiffs in existing litigation, Muslim, Arab, and South Asian organizations who represent affected communities. So that might be one side. And on the other side, and I haven't done too much critical thinking, might be those who think this is a narrower and more thought-through proclamation that is more grounded in a rational basis or a national security justification, that it could pass muster in courts and falls within the president's authority.
Now, Silicon Valley has been among the groups in general lining up as being critical of the travel bans. Any other surprises from within the country?
With respect to last night, I don't know that I've seen new voices surprise us, but I think if we look at the new voices that came out in response and reaction to the rescission of DACA, which was different in many ways, but similar if we're looking at the broader themes of inclusivity and being welcome and recognizing the contributions that immigrants make to the United States, then you see a similarity. And we saw a number of strange bedfellows and unusual allies come out in support of DACA and critical of the DACA rescission. What we might see in the next several days remains to be seen, including but not limited to new legal challenges and statements from unusual allies.
Shoba, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Shoba Sivaprasad Wadia, expert on immigration, looking at new travel restrictions released by the Trump administration last night.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. If you binge watch a whole bunch of episodes of your favorite TV show, you might have fun doing it, but you might be setting yourself up for sleep problems, according to a recent study.
And our next guest says that it's just one way that overusing screens, TVs, phones, computers can be bad for your health.
Jan Vandenbulk is a professor of communication studies at the University of Michigan. He's a co-author of a new study on sleep and binge watching, and he researches the impact of digital media on our health. Jan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Go ahead.
Let's focus in on this new study on binge watching and our sleep. Why is it bad for our sleep?
Well, I think there's something very peculiar about binge watching. I mean, we've been watching television for about 60 years now, so we kind of know what that does and doesn't do to us. But there's something new because of binge watching. We used to have to wait a whole week to watch the next episode of, say, Bonanza or whatever when we were young a long time ago. But now you can if you like something, you can get as much of it as you like. And so by definition, it means you're watching something that really engages you. And television is made that way. If you're watching Game of Thrones and your favorite character is about to die or it looks as if he might die, it's perfectly normal to want to watch the next episode and find out what goes on. But it means that we kind of build up a lot of immersion is a word we like to use. So you get sucked into the story, and that engages us much more than the more traditional ways of watching television, where you may watch a half an hour of sports and maybe some news and a comedy show. That wasn't as exciting and as engaging as what we sometimes do now.
And in this study, you surveyed a bunch of people. I think they were 18 to 25 to find out their binge-watching habits and how they felt, their fatigue, how they slept. What kind of things did you find out?
So what we found is that it does seem to impact sleep in a number of ways. One is it makes it harder to go to bed. And I think a lot of us can relate to that. So that's certainly one thing. But then the other thing is because you get more excited, as it were. I mean, we use the word arousal, but that means a lot more or a lot more different things to us than it does in ordinary life. But so you get mentally aroused, you get excited when you watch something you really like, and that makes it harder to fall asleep once you finally manage to go to bed. So that's the second part of the equation.
It's not just binge watching. You say you've been studying the impacts of a lot of kinds of media use on our sleep and on health more generally. What made you tackle that topic?
Well, so media use is often seen as something trivial because what we do with the media is often seen as trivial. You know, you're going through Facebook pages. It's even hard to describe what you're actually doing when you do that. And so there was a time when we used to think that that's just trivial. It's just stuff we do to fill time. But gradually you see that more and more of what we do in life seems to be tied to the media. People now have trouble staying away from Facebook at work. And I think the best example is now that most of us have smartphones, we carry a little device with us all the time that gives us television if we want it. We can watch movies. We can check our work emails. We can go on Instagram and all the stuff that distracts us. And we take it to bed with us. And sometimes people say, well, you know, that doesn't apply to me. Well, if you're not the person who watches television in bed, you're probably going to be the person who checks his emails right before he goes to bed just to make sure nothing important happens. So not everyone, but most of us struggle one way or the other with limiting our media use because access to it has become so easy.
We're talking to Jan Vandenbalt from the University of Michigan about how our screen habits from TVs to smartphones affect our sleep and our health. And Jan, in a talk you gave that I watched online, maybe ironically, I don't know, but you talked about the big problem, not just being media in and of itself, but mindless media consumption. What do you mean by mindlessness in this
case? I don't say that media use is bad. In fact, I'm someone who watches a lot of television and I enjoy doing it. But what I think the issue is with a lot of our media use is exactly that, mindlessness. And by that I mean we don't really pay much attention to it. Like as a researcher, that's actually a problem for me because if I ask people, how often did you go on Facebook yesterday, or how many hours of television did you watch? That's actually a really tough question to answer because we don't really think that much about it. So that's, in my view, that's the big issue at the moment. And it also tells us what we can do about it because I'm not telling people watch less television or stay off of Facebook or something like that. I just think that it's healthier for all of us to be a little bit more aware of what we're doing. I know that if I watch certain TV shows late at night and I start binging, that it's going to be difficult for me to go to bed on time or I may end up having nightmares. Well, if you're aware of that, and once you become aware of that, then that tells you maybe this isn't the show to watch right now. So that doesn't mean you can't watch any television. It doesn't even mean you can't binge anymore, but it means that you have to become aware of your triggers.
And the tricky thing here is, you know, Facebook and Twitter, they're bottomless. You can always keep scrolling. The binge watching, there's always another episode until you finally run out of the last season. All these things seem to be designed to keep us watching without thinking, without consciously deciding to keep going. Is that right?
Exactly. That's the thing. We make a decision, sometimes consciously, sometimes not, but we make a decision to start doing this. But we almost never make a decision to end doing this. So you just tell yourself, I'll have a quick look at my emails, or let's just have a quick update of what's going on Twitter. But then you see something interesting, or you click on a link or something, and you're hooked. And I think that's what happens a lot of the time. And that's what's making this so difficult, because almost any other thing in life, we are somehow in control. But here, the media are designed to make us like them. That's why we're watching. That's why we want to see the next episode. And so there's this sort of external power that's making it really difficult for us I'm going to say something that I don't mean literally, but it's almost as if we have trouble regaining consciousness and getting back in control.
Let's get more into the health consequences now, because you went into, in addition to studying communications, you studied epidemiology. So you mentioned that people think of our media consumption as trivial, and I think a lot of people don't think of sleep as a big deal. But if we're losing sleep because of our media consumption, that has serious effects on us, doesn't it?
Right, and I think the right way to look at this is it's okay to lose sleep once. I mean, if something important is going on today, I mean, ask any student, then you can always give up 1 or 2 hours of sleep. But if you do this regularly, you're starting to build up a problem. And we live in a society where you're not supposed to care that much about sleep, so it's really tempting to go to bed too late again and to use up some of that time. It feels as if it's unproductive time, but in the long run, lack of sleep is a serious issue. I mean, it affects school grades, it affects work performance, it's been tied to car accidents and what have you, so it's a big deal.
And you're also worried about obesity related to our screen consumption, and in a talk you said, well, people think, oh, we're not consuming calories by looking at a screen, but in fact, we usually are, it sounds like.
Well, yes. So the screen itself doesn't do anything to us. I mean, it's not as if the rays that come from television make us gain weight. But what often happens, and I'm certainly someone who struggles with that, is, you know, you're watching television, you get used to having a snack, and then you get distracted, and before you know it, even though you didn't plan to, you end up eating a whole bag of potato chips, for instance, or consuming, I don't know, a gallon of soda or something along those lines. And again, I don't think there's anything wrong with any of that behavior as long as you know when to start and when to stop.
How do we start to cue ourselves to, you know, have an end time to our TV watching session or our social media or email session, and maybe an end point for that bag of potato chips before we finish the whole thing?
Well, with very few exceptions, I don't think most of us are in a lot of trouble, so we don't have to beat ourselves up about it. But and that means that it's okay to have an occasional binge, and it's okay to miss a couple of hours of sleep for if something important is happening in your life or something you really care about. But I think it is good to become more aware of it and to teach yourself those little triggers. I mean, one little thing, but that could make a big difference, is something like Netflix starts the next episode within seconds unless you're really alert and you're able to make that decision to stop watching really fast. Well, you can switch that off. You can go to the options in Netflix and make it so you have to consciously decide to watch the next episode. It won't stop you if you're someone who has no self-control. But if you're someone who worries about this and thinks, yeah, that actually makes sense, that's a good thing to work on, then you've just regained a little bit of control. You've added that little moment where you can tell yourself, maybe I shouldn't watch the next episode. There's always tomorrow.
How about kids who are growing up in an era of infinite media availability? What do we tell them? What do we teach them?
Well, there's a couple of things, and I think one big thing that we as parents are insufficiently aware of is kids learn by modeling. If you tell your kids they shouldn't be doing that, or they shouldn't be watching so much television, or they shouldn't be on Instagram all the time, there's a good chance that you as a parent have your laptop open or your phone at that moment, and you're actually going through your emails or something like that. So that's a big first step. Just realize that when you're doing this stuff, those little eyes are looking at you and they're learning. So that's one thing. The other thing is they grow up with this stuff much more than we did, and I think this still applies to most parents out there. So they've never known anything else, and they probably need a little bit more guidance than we would have needed in the same circumstances. So don't take this for granted and realize that your kids need to be told when it's good for them to spend less time with the media. Again, I'm not saying they shouldn't, because they get a lot out of it. Schools expect them to use all this stuff for homework and whatnot. But it's good to be more aware of this and to turn this into conscious decisions instead of allowing the screen to make the decisions for us.
A lot of food for thought. Jan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Jan Vandenbulk, professor of communication studies at the University of Michigan. We've been talking about his research on the health impacts of too much screen time.